virus and the vaccine for schools and for South Florida. Who and how are they getting vaccinated, and who should be next? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Local school districts are pushing to get teachers prioritized for vaccines. As the second semester of the school year gets underway, what will be different for teachers, students, and families as the pandemic continues? New vaccine sites are opening, but supplies remain very limited. So where are the shots? Who's getting the doses? And the boss of Miami-Dade County Republicans on impeachment and the party after President Trump.
Until he decides what he's going to do, I think it's incumbent upon the local parties to carry that mantle.
It's all ahead on the South Florida Roundup with your phone calls and tweets. Made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public radio. We've got a lot to talk about regarding vaccines and the COVID-19 virus in our region. We'll begin with schools. The second half of the school year is or about to get underway as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to rage across the community and vaccines are slow to come by. South Florida school officials are pushing to get teachers and staff among the people prioritized to get vaccinated. Right now in Florida, there are three types of people at the top of the list for shots: residents and workers at nursing homes, people 65 years old and older, and healthcare workers who have direct contact with patients. Now, hospitals also are given the chance to vaccinate people they think are extremely vulnerable to the virus. Teachers are not explicitly on that list. That's included in a December executive order from Governor Ron DeSantis. This is Broward County Superintendent Robert Runcie on Wednesday this week on a district webinar.
Our schools are essential to the function of our economy. And if we're serious about opening our economy, we cannot do that without fully opening our schools. We must prioritize our public school teachers and staff for this vaccine.
Runcie said the Broward School District has the space to administer the vaccine in school buildings. It was a similar refrain heard from the Miami-Dade County Public School Board. This is board member Dorothy Bendros-Mendigal.
Teachers, specialist instructional support personnel, aides, food service, and custodial workers and principals as a priority group for the administration of the vaccines. We include all personnel.
What is the state of the virus in public schools as another pandemic semester begins? If you have a student, teach, work in a school, have you been quarantined? Should online students who may be fallen behind be brought back into the classroom? Let's talk about that now here on the South Florida Roundup with your phone calls, your input. Share your story. 800-743-WLRN as we're live on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-9576. You can also join us on Twitter at WLRN. Be sure to tag us with that handle at WLRN. Colleen Wright is education reporter with our partner, the Miami Herald. Scott Travis covers education for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. To each of you, welcome back to the Roundup. Colleen, let me begin with you in Dade County. What's the state of the virus among students and teachers?
I'm hearing from some teachers, parents, and even nurses overseeing schools that some schools are actually sitting pretty empty these days. That's been described to me as around 40%. You know, that changes all the time, though, as kids and teachers go in and out of quarantine. I mean, I've heard from, and it's been discussed publicly at the school board, that, you know, you might be done with one quarantine and you might find yourself back in another one just because of how the protocols are set up. But they haven't changed those protocols. So they're going by the same protocols they have since the first semester. So it's just kind of hard to pinpoint exactly what. But at least as of November 9th, that's a little dated. But it seems like the majority, 55% versus 45%, are doing online school as a choice.
I know for a fact of some classes that have one student present in a classroom with the rest of the students quarantined because of possible exposure in another class. Scott Travis in Broward County, what about the state of the virus?
Yeah, in Broward County, it has been even lower. Broward County has the lowest rate of students attending school than any district in the state. I don't know that the cases have been any greater than any other district on a per capita basis, but only about depending on what day you ask, anywhere between 17 and 27% of kids are learning on campus. Now, they made a big push recently because of kids that were struggling through distance learning to try to get them back. I have not seen a lot of evidence that they have been able to bring a lot of kids back. There was a report that said that they had brought back maybe 20,000 or so, going from about 38,000 to 58,000. But that seemed to be compared to October, not recently. A lot of kids started coming back during the semester, last semester.
I want to ask both of you about how the districts have responded to the second semester expectations from the state to try to encourage students that are falling behind academically to come back into the classroom. But as we talk about the state of the virus in the schools and teachers, what about these efforts that have begun to certainly pick up a bit more public momentum in the past week, Colleen, in Miami and Scott in Broward, about the efforts to prioritize teachers for vaccinations? It was just maybe 2 weeks ago, Colleen, that the governor was very explicit to say teachers are not on the priority list yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Miami-Dade County Public Schools has actually done maybe as much as they can. I don't know, but they've made it clear that they see that teachers being vaccinated are a priority. Superintendent Carvalho wrote a letter to Governor Ron DeSantis and to General Surgeon Scott Ribke, asking for teachers to be prioritized, respectfully asking. And as you just played the audio, a school board member yesterday, Dorothy Vendras-Mindigal, passed unanimously with consent from and support from all 8 other board members, you know, calling for advocating on pretty much every level, the Florida Department of Health, the governor's office, to get teachers vaccinated. That, it seems like they're doing all they can. They've been pretty clear on that platform.
Scott, I think that the Broward County superintendent, what was it last week, I think, had a meeting with the Broward County state legislative delegation. Long list of issues to talk about ahead of the state legislative issue in public school districts. But I imagine at the top of that list was some lobbying for teacher vaccinations.
That's correct, although I'm not sure how much effect that the legislature is going to have on that issue. It tends to be something that is in the hands of the governor, and he has thus far said that teachers would not be on that priority list. Now, he did say that they're hoping when the new Johnson & Johnson vaccination comes, that will be a single dose vaccination as opposed to the current one, which requires 2 different doses. They think that'll be easier to send to schools and other workplaces. And he said that when that comes, maybe teachers can be added to the list at that time.
Now, in that Venn diagram of who is eligible to be vaccinated in Florida and who is not, there are teachers, public school teachers, who are over 65 years old, certainly, who could still get vaccinated under this executive order, and teachers who their healthcare provider may consider them especially vulnerable and thus fall under that last category of folks that could be eligible for a vaccine under that executive order. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number, talking about vaccinations and the vaccine in public schools. 800-743-9576. Connie is up in Margate. Connie, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hello. Hello. I just wanted to say that I think Governor DeSantis's order of preference for people who get the vaccines are very wrong. First people that should get all the vaccines are all the healthcare workers, all the nurses, doctors, et cetera, on and on, EMT, ambulance drivers, all that should get the vaccine first. Secondly, fine, if they want to do all the people in the nursing homes, the residents, and the, you know, all the people that work there, they should be next. Now, the people that people don't have to get it that are 65 and older. I'm 73. I'm in excellent health. I don't need to get it now. My husband, on the other hand, is going to be 77. He's got a serious heart problem. He needs it. I think the age for the seniors should be 75 and up. Now, the teachers, all the frontline workers, the teachers, everybody that works in school needs to get it. We can't demand that teachers go back to school and they're not protected. Maybe the kids don't carry it as often, but they can carry it. They're in contact with family members and other people. They can bring it to school, make the teachers sick, and it will spread like wildfire. That's just craziness not to get the teachers involved. And all the other frontline workers, people that work in grocery stores, bus drivers, I can't think of everybody right now, but people that have to work that are working need it. Then people that are maybe 65 and older.
Connie, I appreciate you sharing that well thought out argument there. You've been thinking about this a lot. Best to you. And it sounds like your husband may have a birthday coming up sometime soon. So happy pre-birthday for him. But I appreciate your thoughts there, Connie and Margate.
I got a quick question.
Go.
How do I contact the governor? How do I contact, who is that, Moskowitz? I call. I never can get through. I leave messages. I'm sure they don't listen. And you know what else I need? I need to get together with another group online, because we need the power of numbers to inundate these people with emails and phone calls to tell them they need to do the right thing, which they are not. If you could help me with that, to tell me, to connect me with other people that we can protest safely via email and so forth, I really want to do that, because we need to get our Florida government straightened out. They are not doing the right thing by the people in this state.
Connie, I hear your frustration. Thank you for putting voice to it here on the South Florida Roundup. 800-743-9576 to have your voice be heard, talking about vaccinations, particularly as it relates to public schools in South Florida. 800-743-9576. Colleen Wright covers education for our partner, the Miami Herald. Scott Travis covers that topic for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. You hear Connie's frustration, her list of who should be prioritized in terms of vaccinations. I want to take each of you back to the days in late September and early October, as the school districts were putting together their reopening plans to bring students and teachers back to campus, and some of the criteria that the districts set out to be met in order to reopen the schoolhouse doors. One big one, of course, was the community testing, the community positivity rate, daily positivity rate, right? And the trend of that. Colleen, I know you've heard this from teachers, probably parents and students. We're well above today a community positivity rate where we were in October when schools reopened. Is there any talk, any chance of curtailing in-class instruction because of the positivity rate?
None. And that will probably never happen, at least for now. The governor's executive or emergency order was very clear that they want schools open. And Miami-Dade County Public Schools has been treading very lightly. I think only two schools have been shut down for a day because of positive cases, to sanitize and just send everyone home for a little bit. I think, and that won't happen again. I mean, the school district won't even disclose how many are in quarantine publicly. And the argument that's been made is they really just don't want to tick off Tallahassee. And the reason why is because Tallahassee is funding school districts now at last year's funding level. So all the students, you know, they're funding them as if it was the 2019-2020 school year. Because, of course, you know, people say, like, well, if a student is home learning online, do they really need to be funded at the same level as someone in school? Of course, you can imagine that would put pressure on schools if that was the case to get kids in. The state didn't want to do that. So the school district really doesn't want to mess with their funding at all. That is why they've, you know, kept schools open. And even though the second semester of this year started with positivity rates over 10%. The criteria that a bunch of experts, a whole panel of medical and public health experts agreed on, is about 8 criteria. And one of them was that the rate had to be trending toward 5, lower than 10 and trending toward 5. And then it got a little looser. That, like, well, we don't have to follow all 8 to the law. And then now it's just kind of a guidance. But I can tell you that I would be shocked if any school closed from here to the end of the school year. They're just not going to do it. They don't want to risk the funding being lost, because they would be in trouble. They already lost 6,000 students just in, like, the first month at traditional public schools. And traditional public school enrollment has been in free fall for 15 years. They really don't want to mess with their funding. I doubt it would happen.
Scott, let me ask you about the second semester, the spring semester, so to speak, already underway in Broward. Many months ago, the State Department of Education required school districts to have an intervention plan for struggling students in the spring semester. And many of those plans talked about enhanced outreach. What does that mean in Broward? And what are the risks for those struggling students? And how is the school district addressing those risks?
Well, for all 3 South Florida school districts, and I'm sure many others too, academic performance really has plummeted during the semester. The number of students getting Fs had dropped, or probably more than doubled. in both Broward and Miami-Dade County. So there's a belief that the education at home is not really working for a lot of kids. And then you add also the fact that the governor is insisting that schools are not a place of spread. And the school districts are saying that too. Whether that's true or not, I guess I'm not clear. There was a case in Palm Beach County where a bunch of kids spread COVID to each other on an athletic bus after a football game. So there has been some evidence of spread, but it does not seem to be any widespread outbreaks. What we don't know is that because there's so few kids on campuses, and also the schools are doing a pretty good job of requiring people to wear masks and social distancing and stuff like that. So what would happen if you start bringing all these kids back? Would then we start having outbreaks? Yeah. And that's really unclear.
Yeah. And, some of those folks that are advocating to bring students back, and research shows obviously in-person instruction is preferable compared to online instruction, but that risk of infection, and if you don't have robust testing involved, that can present yet another challenge to that. Charlie is up next here on the phone from Coconut Creek. Hi, Charlie. Well, thanks for calling in.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. I just wanted to weigh in on the situation here in Broward County. Mm-hmm. My son is in seventh grade. He's been at home online learning since January of last year. Just recently, his seventh grade counselor called and was wondering if he would be coming back to in-person schooling. But I had to inform her that my wife has a compromised immune system, and we just learned today, technically today, she's 6 weeks pregnant. So,
well, congratulations, Charlie. Let's pause and enjoy that for a moment. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate that. But I did inform her of these things, and she did understand. That was last week, January 5th or something. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
And then a couple of days later, the principal automated message came in that our school has had COVID tested positive and wasn't specific on if it was faculty or student, but it just came as a shock that, the counselor was requesting or seeing if he was coming back to school in person. And then a few days later, I hear a message that our school has COVID positive cases. So,
Reinforce your decision. Charlie, the call from the counselor was that, and you don't have to answer this because it's your child involved, but I'm just curious, do you know what spurred that call?
I know exactly. His grades were slipping in the first semester during online schooling, but my wife and I made it our mission to have him bring those grades up, and I'm happy to say he's all back to B's and C's at this moment. So they, they are aware that his grades were slipping, but we were tenacious. We were just, on top of him as much as we could to keep his grades at a normal average level. And so far he's able to maintain, as long as, I've been hearing mixed things about schooling and students not doing as well online.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think it boils down to the parents just making sure they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Well, Charlie, well done on that. And congratulations on new baby to come in the months ahead. Charlie in Coconut Creek there. In our final moments here, Colleen Wright with the Herald and Scott Travis with Broward County. Districts and parents and teachers looking, day to day, week to week. But already, right? I mean, there has to be conversation about the next school year in August and September. Colleen, you first, and then Scott. What's the tone of that conversation? Is it 100% back in the classroom? Is that the expectation?
I believe it is. I haven't heard anything to the contrary. I feel like a lot can happen between now and August. Yeah. As the rest of the general population gets vaccinated. But I did want to touch on a point real quick about academic progress.
Yeah.
At least in Miami, as it was kind of touched on in this emergency order, that students who were not doing well in online learning would have to be asked back. The school district, Miami-Dade County Public School District, sent out 10,000 of these notices. But if you were to do math, there's about 165,000 or so kids who are doing online school. So that's 141 1,000. And this is from November, so it's not super accurate. But that's about 7% who aren't doing as well, who got noticed. That seems a little low to me. Of course, that's not counting students who maybe are in school but are falling behind. But something I want to point out real quick is that the district's also having a problem with absentee rates, but not so much for the ones who are at home. For the ones who are going into school in grades 6 through 12, we're seeing way higher absentee rates for the ones who are supposed to be there. So it's a very confusing situation, and honestly, I think next year's a wild card, but I haven't heard anything about shutting down schools. I mean, I believe they're probably going to be open just as they are now.
Yeah. Scott, what's the presumption right now for the fall in Broward?
Well, I think there's a lot of uncertainty because nobody knows what the funding situation is going to be like. They got they were fortunate to not have their funding cut for this school year, even though they lost a ton of students. And as Colleen said, that typically online education is funded at a lower level than in-person education. So if the school district wanted to continue the online education model for next school year, they would get a lot less money. And then you couple that with the fact that they've lost probably 8,000 or 9,000 students, and it would just be devastating. So I think they're trying to save some of the CARES Act money that they're getting to try to cushion that. But I mean, it could be really ugly where you have teacher layoffs and other devastating cuts.
And looking ahead, of course, to the Biden administration and just the what the president-elect has talked about, the first down payment of stimulus efforts and school districts potentially being included in that spending as we look at that legislation over the next few weeks. Scott Travis, covering education for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Colleen Wright does the same for our partner, the Miami Herald. Colleen and Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We got more to come. The latest on how much vaccine is actually here in our region, where it is, and who's getting it. Share your story with us now. 800-743-WLRN. 800-743-9576. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. More vaccination sites opened in South Florida this week, and when website appointments were opened, they were filled awfully quickly, usually within just minutes. Here's the director of the Florida Department of Health in Broward County, Dr. Paula Thacke, on a conference call with mayors Thursday.
We do appreciate everybody's patience. It has not gone as smoothly as we had intended, traffic and otherwise, as a consequence to the glitch in the appointment system. But again, we are serving seniors.
Miami's Jackson Health System CEO Carlos Magoya told Miami-Dade County Commissioners Thursday the hospital system is working with 25 local places of worship to boost vaccinations. Jackson inoculated 2,000 people through its partnership with Black churches on Thursday.
We had a very, very large number of Black people that got vaccinated, and it was such a success, we're going to do it again next week.
Magoya says Jackson employees can also choose two qualifying family members to get vaccinated in an effort to extend access to more Black people 65 years old and older. So what's your vaccination story? Have you tried to get that appointment? Have you or a family member gotten a dose? 800-743-WLRN to share your story. 800-743-9576. Or you can hit us up on Twitter at WLRN. Veronica Zaragovia is the healthcare reporter here at WLRN. Ben Konar covers healthcare for our partner, the Miami Herald. Veronica and Ben, welcome to the roundup. Veronica, how have vaccinations gone this week?
Well, Tom, it's changing by the day because, for instance, Carlos Magoya yesterday had said that next week the hospital system would get 7,000 vaccines, and that's down from what had been promised, 14,000. Then it ended up being 8,000 in the middle of the commissioner's meeting. So it's just fluctuating all the time. We're still hearing from seniors who are going either across our county region in South Florida or going elsewhere to Fort Pierce. I interviewed one woman who went there, or Orlando or Tampa. So there's still a lot of frustration because the demand outpaces supply, but there are a lot of partnerships that are starting now to make the process more efficient. Counties teaming up with the Florida Division of Emergency Management or with the National Guard, and so we're seeing a lot of that too.
Ben, tell us a little bit about those distribution sites. Demand remains sky high. Supply, as Veronica just laid out there, changes minute by minute sometimes in terms of what these health systems are learning to what to expect. But yet we're still seeing vaccination sites open up. So how confident are these sites in getting that supply to be able to fulfill the appointments they're taking?
I would say not a high degree of confidence right now. Everything, as Veronica pointed out, is really changing day to day. There's not a lot of planning ahead that can be done when you don't know how many doses are arriving and when. So, you know, what you're seeing is kind of the beginning of an infrastructure being set up. You have the hospitals, you know, Jackson Health, you have Mount Sinai, you have Baptist, Memorial, all these hospitals that are starting to do their own efforts. And then you have, as Veronica mentioned, these other sites that are coming online. It's the beginning of setting up a distribution method. But, you know, as as Veronica said, the main question right now is when are the doses getting here and how many are we getting? And there's just not a lot of planning you can do without that information, especially when you're having to schedule appointments ahead of time.
And we mentioned some of these sites, Veronica, that are coming online today on this Friday. I think there's a site, at the Miami Zoo.
Exactly. That one starting up today. And then next week midweek, the Marlins Park will open up. And that one will be a collaboration among the City of Miami, Miami-Dade County, the Florida Division of Emergency Management, and National Guard members. And but like Ben was talking about, I mean, we had heard in the commissioner's meeting yesterday that the state is choosing to send some dosages to rural areas, for instance, in Pensacola. And so that Miami-Dade County will not be receiving more doses than what's already been allotted. So, for instance, they don't think that Zoo Miami would have more than what it has to operate to start up today. Next week, some of the sites won't get more and might be closed.
You mentioned the Marlins Park vaccination site. Ben, some colleagues at the Miami Herald reporting that the city of Miami, Mayor Francis Suarez particularly, is asking the state for permission to have a city of Miami residency requirement?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're asking the state, but it seems like the ultimate authority lies within the federal government, which has control over the distribution of these vaccines. And, you know, this was one of the first questions that came up when we started seeing these vaccines start to trickle down here. There were a lot of people who were wondering about snowbirds, for instance. And then, you know, even in a more granular level, you had Mount Sinai, the first hospital to start offering vaccines to the public. They said that, you know, they weren't going to restrict it to Miami Beach residents. You had a lot of concern about people driving down to Miami to get it. And the way it's been explained to me by Jared Moskowitz, who kind of runs the show when it comes to vaccine distribution in Florida.
He's the state emergency management director.
Correct. Yes. And, you know, it's a federal resource and that we don't have the ability to say it's only for Florida residents, let alone saying it's only for, you know, Miami-Dade or Broward County residents. So there's just, you know, it's just unclear how the Miami mayor will achieve what he sets out to do. I understand why he wants to do it, but logistically, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. Although, as my colleagues have covered, that's what they're going for.
Yeah. Taking your questions, your comments on Twitter at WLRN. Be sure to tag us. We've got one comment here, Veronica. Perhaps you can help this person out. I'm in Broward County, they write, and have registered for an appointment, but never got email confirmation. How do I check when it's my appointment? The site browardhealth.org is not accessible anymore. The user on Twitter writes us. And this is a story that you've heard from folks within the past week to 10 days.
Absolutely. And I wish that I could have a clear answer, because when it comes to if this appointment was made through Broward Health, the hospital system, they have been very adamant that if they made an appointment, they have the dose available, and they've actually given people both their appointments right away. If it's through the county, I've heard both, I've been there personally and seen that sometimes people had that situation where they don't have an email confirmation and they get turned away. Other times they might get let through if there are enough dosages. And I see the frustration, for instance, on Twitter, or people reaching out to me that they have nobody to ask. And frankly, I don't either. And it's very difficult to get an answer to that.
Ben, you've heard a lot of these complaints, concerns, frustrations, and, you know, we're resourceful people being in South Florida, trying to figure out ways to not really hack a system, but to get around these shortcomings, and especially for loved ones or close neighbors who fit the vulnerability eligibility, to try to secure some of these appointments. What are some of the stories you've heard?
Well, you know, we get a lot of stories about people who try over and over again and can't get an appointment. And then, you know, I would say the most notable thing for me as a reporter is not so much the stories, because they're all similar, but who we're hearing from. You know, a lot of people that call the newspaper, at least, they don't necessarily have people who can help them, you know, refresh a website every other second. That, you know, it's kind of leading to these inequities in who's able to sign up and who isn't. And I think we're hearing county officials and others start to talk about this. But I don't know if there's really enough being done. And it seems like it's kind of a reactive system right now. You know, vaccines become available, appointments run out, and that's that. But, you know, if you're, you know, I think the other part of it that we're not discussing is vaccine hesitancy. The idea that everyone is going to want a vaccine isn't really something we've seen in the populations that have gotten it so far, except for the senior population. So that's also going to lead to inequities down the line where you are kind of just going where the demand is and not thinking about it from kind of a wider public health perspective.
Yeah, that's a good point. And certainly that's one that's perhaps further down the line when this kind of initial demand gets addressed with the supply. But back to the kind of process of even learning about the appointments being opened up. Ben, I think it may have been you that talked about, you know, even setting, you know, if you or, you know, maybe a elderly aunt or parent or neighbor, you know, they're not plugged into a smartphone and have a Twitter account, but maybe you can set an alert for if one of these public health agencies sends out a note to say, hey, we're going to open up the site again at 4 o'clock and we've got 5,000 doses, or we're going to open it up at 10 o'clock so that you know when these things are going to happen.
Right. Well, that just occurred to me when I was seeing how these appointment availability was being announced on Twitter. And I was seeing it right away because I have tweet alerts set for the mayor and also Jackson Health System. And I thought to myself, you know, it's kind of weird that the best advantage you can have on getting an appointment is having tweet alerts set up. Yeah. So I just, you know, kind of put that out there and say, hey, you know, if you don't know how to do this, I'll teach you how. It shouldn't just be me retweeting and you happening to see it that gets you a chance at this life-saving vaccine. So, you know, a few people DM'd me after that and said, yes, please tell me how to set up a tweet alert. So I just think that's a great example of how this has been kind of reactive to the demand that's there, to the people who are able to navigate it. And just getting back to something you said, where it's going to be a problem down the line, the public health experts I'm talking to say it's a problem right now, because one of the best ways to address vaccine hesitancy
in terms of the
to get it early on in the process. In other words, that's part of the debate around whether we should be ignoring essential workers. You know, essential workers disproportionately come from low income, sometimes community of color, and if you get them on board early, you start to build that buy-in early in the process. So it's not 2 months down the line, you're going into communities in Miami-Dade County and saying, why doesn't anyone want a vaccine? The idea is to get ahead of the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Build that support and the knowledge and the communication up early in the system. Good point, Ben. Ben Konar covers healthcare for the Miami Herald. Veronica Zaragovia covers healthcare for WLRN. Taking your questions, your thoughts about vaccinations this week in South Florida. Let's go to Pembroke Pines. Andre is on the telephone. Andre, thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Oh, thank you. My mother is a nurse at University of Miami. And what I was saying is that many people are getting vaccinated, but it's a very fragmented system. It's not like how I believe they're doing it in other countries where the government is pretty much stepping in. Each hospital system, because I work up in Gainesville at Chan Hospital, part of the UF Health, and we have access to the vaccine, but only at our hospital, for example. So each hospital system is kind of doing their own thing individually.
Yeah.
And I think that's a sorry to cut you off, but I think that's actually a problem that we've seen, that oftentimes in this whole COVID-19, we've seen how fragmented our healthcare system truly is. And I think that's beginning to hit a lot of people.
Yeah, Andre, really good point. Never apologize for cutting me off. The audience hears enough from me. We want to hear from you and the callers, Andre. I appreciate you sharing that because that really has shown a light on the decentralized system here, from the federal government to the state, to the hospitals, to individual medical centers. And then, of course, the other side of this, or the other system, distribution system, through Walgreens and CVS, into long-term care facilities. Andre in Pembroke Pines, thank you for that phone call. Up in Hollywood, David is up next. David, you're on the radio.
The whole thing was handled wrong from the beginning. Should have been declared a national emergency. FEMA should have taken over from the very beginning and distributed the vaccines and the COVID testing through FEMA, through the National Guard. There's plenty of military doctors to go around, and there's no reason why they don't engage them.
Yeah. David, I appreciate that. In fact, it has been declared a national emergency early on back, 10, 11 months or so ago. Veronica, to David's point, though, about kind of centralizing distribution here in Florida through the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Here in Florida, we have the emergency management director who normally, you know, is on board for natural disasters directing the state effort. And at the local level, it's the local emergency management directors and fire chiefs that are kind of the point people on these vaccination distribution points, correct?
Right, correct. And something that struck me yesterday was I was listening to Frank Rollison from the Miami-Dade. He's the director of the Miami-Dade Emergency Management, explaining some issues. And I was listening to how, for instance, some sites are open, the county sites in Miami-Dade are open from 8 to 4. And then it made me realize, like, that's not a very big span of time for people who are working during those hours, and that operating hours in different counties are likely different. And so also the fact that a lot of these sites are not so convenient in terms of people who don't have a car or who cannot wait hours to get through. So I know they're working on these issues, but it's causing frustration. Yeah.
And Ben, David's idea about the National Guard, I think, is the Guard involved in the Hard Rock vaccination site?
I actually don't know the answer to that off the top of my head, but I know, you know, a lot of this, what we're hearing about the direction it's going is going to be kind of a piecemeal effort. You're going to have some being handled through health departments, some being handled through private contractors, some being handled through pharmacies. But I'm not sure about the Hard Rock site.
I can jump in quickly that when I was at a press conference last week, the National Guard was on site, but they wouldn't tell me how long they'd be there. But just a quick thing to that point that now I just lost my train of thought.
That's all right. We're up with time at the same time, Veronica, so it turns out to be A-OK. But yes, the National Guard is, in fact, involved there. Our producer answered that, and Veronica, you got that in as well, so I appreciate that. Veronica Zaragovia, covering healthcare for WLRN. Ben Konart covers that topic for our partner, the Miami Herald. Thanks, folks. Still to come, the head of the Miami-Dade County Republicans on the impeachment vote and the president's social media ban. That's next as the roundup continues. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. This week's vote in the House of Representatives to impeach President Donald Trump for the second time broke along party lines, at least among Florida's congressional delegation. 11 Democrats supported it, 15 Republicans voted against it, one Central Florida Republican did not vote. The Republican opposition included the three GOP members from here in South Florida, two of whom were sworn in for the first time just days ago. Carlos Jimenez and Maria Salazar each flipped a Democratic seat in Miami-Dade County to the GOP in the November election. Rene Garcia is a Miami-Dade County Commissioner and chairman of the Miami-Dade County Republican Party. We spoke Thursday afternoon. Commissioner Garcia, welcome to WLRN. None of the three Miami-Dade Republican congressional representatives voted to impeach President Trump this week. Was that the right decision for their constituents?
I do think that was the right vote to take. And I say it was the right vote to take because this is a time to heal the country. I think that these impeachment proceedings that they've embarked on with a week left to go in the president's presidency, it adds more and it agitates more that 70 million people that did vote for the president. And while, yes, I recognize that some of his words may have been incendiary in Washington at that rally, I think that the important thing to do now is for this country to come together, to heal the wounds on both sides and start having a dialogue instead of continuously put the finger into the open wounds of this country.
Some would argue that the healing begins with accountability. With the incendiary comments that the president made on January 6th prior to the insurrection, and that those comments were cited in the article of impeachment, not holding the president accountable through any process, how does that accelerate any kind of political healing or societal healing?
But you have to understand where the people are, where a lot of his supporters are, and what they're thinking. Think about this for a minute. Why isn't that same standard used when folks on the left, including the current vice president-elect and others, were agitating individuals when the riots in our cities across the country? We saw what happened in Chicago and Oregon and Washington, where even cities, areas were being commandeered and taken over.
But we did not hear then Senator Kamala Harris say to a crowd, we're going to walk down this street to this building and you need to show strength. You can't take back the country through weakness.
No, but she did say that we are going to continue. We need to fight and we need to fight till the end. I seen comments from her the other day on TV, which she did say these comments. And it's not just about calling her out or calling anyone else out. The problem that we have here and the issue that we have is that there's a double standard. There really is. And the hypocrisy that lies in politics on both sides, not just on one side. We change the narrative only when it's convenient for us. This didn't start with Donald Trump. This started 20 years ago. That we keep on moving, escalating it higher and higher and higher and higher. I call it the yeah, but movement, right? When we see, instead of having adults at the table, that we can sit down and have pragmatic thinkers and say, what is in the best interest of the country? Instead of making it as what's in the best interest for political party or individuals to continue and stay in power. And that's where we have to stop. And as Republicans, we are the party, and I say that as Republican Party chairman, we've always talked about being the party of law and order. And this is why what happened in Washington should not be accepted. It's completely unacceptable. But we should also be able to recognize that the other side, when the riots were going on, they were not called riots. They were called peaceful protesting. And that's not necessarily what happened in a lot of our cities.
Let me ask you, as the chairman of the Republican Party in Miami-Dade County, do you think President Trump is a conservative?
Do I think he's a conservative? No. Yeah, I think he is a conservative.
What does his conservatism hope to conserve?
What does his conservatism hope to conserve? It depends on how you define conservative.
Well, how would you define President Trump's conservatism?
I think that President Trump's conservatism, when you look at the foreign affairs, he looks to bring everything back to America. He looks to put America first, where we haven't done that. You know, we've let that go in the last couple of years. We've eroded our presence across the seas. You know, what he did with China, you can't, you know, it's amazing to me that people forget what the battle that I want to say this, the tariff battle that we had with China.
Chinese imports into the United States are at record levels.
But the tariff, and that's exactly, and that's under the administration and in the negotiations of Donald Trump with the Chinese. And this is exactly where I'm talking about the counterbalance that we need to bring in our foreign affairs. That was one. When we look at the record level of employment that we see here in the United States with African Americans, and I know it sounds like this is the talking points, but just the reality, I see it back in my community. Before we had COVID, we saw what was happening in our country, and we saw what's happening in our local communities with employment and wages and so forth. And that's what his type of conservatism is about putting America first. And this is where we have to remember, when we look at individuals and people, Republicans in this country and the middle class, there has been a forgotten people. And that's these individuals, the Republicans that came out to vote for Donald Trump in the first one and the second round, and the second time in his reelection campaign. And we have to hear their voices as well. We can't continuously, we can't move this country forward if we don't hear the voices of everyone and bring people to the table.
Chairman Garcia, obviously one of those big voices has been President Trump. And we heard that voice on January 6th and for weeks after the election day. And as you know, a lot of people in South Florida have found President Trump's false insistence that he won the election and that the lie that he has told about the election being stolen. They've heard similar refrains heard in the native countries where many voters came from who now live in South Florida. How do you hear that? How do you respond to that?
Look, and Tom, that's a great observation, and that's it's a level of frustration for me. And I'll tell you why it's frustrating, because for that same reason. When we look at what's happened in other countries, and the reason a lot of people have fled their countries and have come over here, is for the freedom to vote, is because we have law and order, is because of our institutions that we hold dearly in this country. And yet when, instead of using the route of the courts, and instead of using the legal channels, they're calling to throw out an election. Listen, was there inconsistencies with some of the elections in some of these states? Absolutely, I think there was.
But there was no inconsistency that was out of an ordinary inconsistency that we see during national presidential elections.
And that's where I was going. That's exactly where I was going. Not anything at the level that will be able to throw out an entire election. Now, I do think that after President Trump leaves office, I hope that he will continue to look at what happened in some of these other states and try to discover a better way to hold their elections.
Looking ahead, Chairman Garcia, the soon-to-be former president, President Trump, is going to be at least a part-time state of Florida resident, part-time resident in Palm Beach County. You're the chairman of the Miami-Dade County Republicans. Should President Trump still be the leader of the GOP?
Well, listen, it depends on what President Trump is going to do.
Well, as the chairman of the Miami-Dade GOP, would you like him to continue to be a leader of the Republican Party?
Depends on what he does. At the national level, we don't have, when the president exits the stage, we don't know how that leadership is going to look and what he's going to do. Until he decides what he's going to do, I think it's incumbent upon the local parties to carry that mantle. One of the things that I focus on and the things that I've been talking about is that we have to be very careful. Although the social issues are extremely important that we have to take on. But right now, the constitutional issues and the constitutional battles that we're facing are much more important and much more important to the democracy of this country. Never did I think that the fighting for the First Amendment, because I always think the First Amendment is under attack. Never in my mind did I ever thought that the First Amendment was the attack that was going to come, was not going to come from government, but it was going to come from the private sector.
Well, the private sector is not a party to the United States Constitution and the First Amendment. The First Amendment is due to protect the private party from government intrusion.
Exactly. And this, but unfortunately, we have been using all these social media platforms and all these, we've given up a lot of those rights to these social media giants. And yet they still don't have, they're not held to the same accountable standards that the press is. So I think this is something that we have to, our country really has to look at. Because the attack is not coming from government, although we have to be very careful that government doesn't try to silence us, because as a Republican and as a proud Republican, as a lifelong Republican, I will fight not only for Republicans' rights to speak up, but for my friends on the Democratic side to have the same exact right. And I think Democrats need to stand up as well and denounce what some of these big companies are doing, and not only limiting the president, but limiting everyone else.
Would you require a Twitter, for instance, to reinstate the real Donald Trump handle?
I think they should. Yes.
But isn't that also a First Amendment violation by the government telling a private company that they must say something?
And this is the uncharted waters that we are right now because of the technology that exists in our country and our world today. I believe that the First Amendment is the First Amendment for everyone, and everyone should be held to the same standard. And you should not be able to censor individuals just because you don't agree with their political views or their stance or anything. Twitter prided itself, as did other social platforms, saying we're an open space for everyone to speak up. And now all of a sudden, we have become so accustomed to using these platforms, now they're going to pick and choose who can say what. That in itself is completely wrong. I will fight to make sure that gets reversed, and we find a way to balance the needs of the individual to be able to speak up and say what they want.
As a Republican, shouldn't the market decide which of those voices on those private platforms is heard and not, as opposed to the government mandating that Facebook or Twitter or Parler have to broadcast these voices?
And that's where we are in the uncharted territory, because we don't want to have to mandate. We hate that word mandate. But then how do you balance out the mandate and censorship? Because I think the freedom of speech should not stop at the front door, you know, when I get on Twitter, you know, so then Twitter's going to pick and choose and filter. That's where a lot of people are getting their information nowadays. The First Amendment should be across the board. You should not be able to censor individuals' freedom to speak.
That was Rene Garcia, Miami-Dade County Commissioner and the chairman of the Miami-Dade Republican Party. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Denise Royal. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. And Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The WLRN Director of Radio Programming is Jason Sabka. Our Director of Radio Operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.